Hello, I'm John Ingold.
And I'm Sagar Barishi.
And welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week, we open the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book to a different article, and we invite the author of that article onto the show to tell us about what they wanted to say and their career and how they approach writing in games. So it's all about the craft of interactive narrative and game writing. And this week we have Ed Stern. Hi, Ed.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure and a delight. So for listeners who are unaware of you by name, could you please sort of outline who are you and how do you fit into the games industry community?
I fit into the games industry? This is very exciting. I see little evidence for this claim. Hello. Yeah, I'm Ed Stern. I did an English degree that turned into a history degree. I thought I was going to be an actor. And then I thought I was going to be a musician. And then I worked in business news TV and then in game TV. And then I got hired by someone who was about to start a game studio, which was called Splash Damage. And I had 23 years with them, which is up until recently, my entire game career. Mainly doing multiplayer first-person shooters, but not exclusively. There was also a bunch of stuff that got cancelled. And I think after two decades, the moral NDA expires. So stuff like there was Secret Wars for Marvel, and it was like, oh, I'm writing lines for Captain America now. Or Inception for Christopher Nolan, which went absolutely nowhere. But I'll just write some dialogue for Christopher Nolan, shall I? That'll be fine. So I never got to do the completely narrative-focused stuff as you guys have been able to do, but it was always on the cusp of, I get to write something other than Grenade or Bang or Medic. Currently freelancing and seeing how game dev works outside of that size of studio, which is a constant shock of, oh, look, games get made in lots of different ways, shapes and forms. And it's one of the things I enjoyed so much listening to the previous episodes of, I guess it's the struggle for all of us, is how much of this kind of theoretical abstract stuff is agnostic of studio size, team size, genre, project, whatever. How much of it is, oh yeah, well, we've learned, because we're writers, right? You know, we start off as being readers and we're already really good at, looking at words on a page and being a location scout and a production manager and a costume designer, because a thing that's hard for people joining the industry and in the industry is just trying to work out how much of the theory, how much of any of the theory can be turned into practice, because different studios and projects and genres, like, they're so different. The portion control is so different. The tone control. And the piece I wrote, The Tina Fey Hat Problem, is, I think in many ways, it's the other end of the telescope from what you guys were talking about in episode one.
I love this, right? Because this is, you know, that how I fall on this problem. I am highly on the side of context hugely matters. And this is what your article is all about, right? So, yeah. So please tell us, like, what brought you to writing The Tina Fey Hat Problem? Why do you think this particular issue is of relevance or importance to you and to the rest of the community?
Well, I should say, okay, this is the Tina Fey hat problem. It's not the Liz England door problem, but you should totally look that up because it is one of the greatest, it may be the best single thing I've seen written on games. Quite inadvertently, it's just the Rosetta Stone for game dev.
It is completely clear, straightforward, and funny, which is the best set of things you can do, right?
Yeah, here's what everybody does. So the Tina Fey hat problem. Tina Fey, fantastic actor, comedian, writer, showrunner. She doesn't actually call it this in her book, which is very good. But I've heard people she've worked with on podcasts refer to it as that. So let's say you're Tina Fey, and let's say you're making 30 Rock, and there's a scene in a script where a character's wearing a hat. Left to their own devices, costume, or maybe props, or millinery, I don't know exactly who, will come up with the funniest hat in the world, which will destroy the joke. Because the joke is not that it's a funny hat, it's funny that character who does not normally wear a hat is wearing a hat in this scene. And her big takeaway from that is how much of being a showrunner isn't so much about being creative as policing other people's enthusiasms. Because otherwise, it's like there's a whole Hollywood joke about how the Oscars aren't for best acting, best costume, best editing. It's always most acting, most costume, most editing. Because generally in game dev, not just in studios, but there's a lot of siloing goes on, and no one has the whole picture in their head, and each individual discipline is trying to do the best they can. So for writers, we try and do everything with words. That's not what it is. And it's one of the toughest things to train in, because it feels like you're intruding on other people's ground. But it's like, no, you've got to. Back when I was hiring people and we're getting to interview stages, all of my questions were, what's your favorite bit of game narrative that isn't dependent on dialogue?
Mm.
Like, that's a different medium. And there were some great examples. Like, some people just didn't get it. And it was always like the bit where, and it was always a cinematic or a bit of kind of, you know, explicit dialogue or explicit narrative. But great answers, like in Limbo, you know, the kind of the first of those hapless left to right child murdering games. Yeah. So they set it up. It's quite early on. They set up the idea that you run into the middle of the screen, left to right, and there's a problem, and then you react to it. And quite early on, you get to the middle of the screen, and an enormous monster spider turns up behind you, and the music doesn't change.
Yep. This is the world. This is the status quo of the world.
Because the game isn't on your side. It's perfect. I mean, strictly speaking, not narrative. It's certainly not dialogue. But in terms of the whole game in one go, it's like, oh, this is a game that is indifferent to this child. And that's
actively hostile at times.
Yeah. But not even kind of vengeful, just like it's completely immaterial to the game whether you live or die. It's not about you, which is that it's like a perfect chord that game just plays again and again, and each time it's brilliant. So that's absolutely a statement of the central thesis of the game. It's not done through dialogue. And the problem as writers, because, you know, we love our words. We are readers first. We start off being readers, and then we become prose writers, and then we do our Robert McKee and Snyder and our hero's journey, and we learn all these tricks. And then we never have a gig where we play any of those scales that we've learned. It's sort of one of my favorite episodes of MASH. Very old sort of 70s, 80s US sitcom.
Well, the classic.
The Korean War. I'm startlingly good. And in a mobile army surgical hospital, hence MASH, in the Korean War, standing in for the Vietnam War. And the character Hawkeye is always complaining about the food, and because reasons, he ends up in charge of the kitchen. And he's there saying, now, the thing about French toast is you've got to add the milk to the eggs gently as you whisk them. And the chef is standing there, like, hairy-armed in a singlet vest, and he's got a huge metal bin behind him and a sack of white powder and a sack of yellow powder. And he empties one sack in after the other and then gets a hose of water and starts pouring water in while he stirs it with an oar and goes, gently, you say? And that immediately made me think of game narrative.
Yes.
Like, you know, we've got all these perfect, like, bespoke solutions. We train, you know, we're kind of Michelin-starred. Our technique, our mise en, you know, like, our mise, not mise en scène, mise en place is like perfect, and then we are just making cheese sandwiches, like, yes, or
over and over.
Or it's the school play, like, you know, if the school fencing team want there to be three sword fights, there's gonna be three sword fights, and you just don't want anyone to laugh for the wrong reasons. Like, well, that applied writing, that kind of practical thing, is how do we bridge that gap? And all the things that should be good practice, like we're doing the better writing, better words, more words, are actually getting in the way.
I completely get you. Are you? Would it be fair to say that part of your argument is that perhaps subtlety is especially difficult in our medium, maybe because of how disparate the different disciplines are and how difficult it is to keep everyone kind of coordinated under one umbrella? So is it the case, therefore, that we might do better at stories that are less subtle, that are a little bit more bombastic?
Mm. Good question. I think sometimes genre organizes your content and tone for you. And there are some very good games that, you know, deliver much better by doing a thing that already everyone knows how to enjoy. I mean, good, you know, the not the shadow, but like the effect that the movie Aliens has had on the games industry, certainly in terms of dialogue, but also put someone with short hair and a green uniform on the bridge of a spaceship and you are 90%. Oh, I get it. I get it. This is, and for example, I worked on a game called Brink, which had some ideas going on, but we could never explain it. It's like, well, it's like this thing you haven't heard of crossed with this other thing you don't know about. And we were doing the same press at the same time as Left 4 Dead 2. You know, Valve were doing that. L4D2, down to the logo, it told you how to play. Oh, I get it. There's zombies. There's four of you split up. You're going to die. That's perfect. That is like, you know, in terms of applied copywriting, that's brilliant writing. That, you know, that's, but the narrative experience is, it's telling you how to enjoy it. Like that, just from the box art, was, you know, a masterclass. And we were like, well, it's kind of a thing. But I think, I mean, just going back to what you guys were talking about in episode one, about, a lot of it is down to org chart and workflow. And a thing, I mean, there are some conversations in games, but we generally, we're training in the wrong industry. As you say, like we're training how movies get made. And movies, like the job titles have changed a bit, mainly with digital art, but generally, if you look at the credits of a movie, they're the same from the 1930s as they are from the 2020s. There's a basic understanding of how to get a movie made. Oh, well, we're going to need a prop. We've got a first AD and a lighting, and we need an electrician. And here's how locations work, and here's how sets work. A guy I used to work with in TV went on to work for a games publisher you have heard of. And we bumped into each other at GDC one year, and we went to a quiet corner. And he said, Ed, for God's sake, if telly got made the way games get, wait, it would just be bars and tone on every TV in the world 24/7. You know, just the test card and the, ooh, you know, audio signal. Just the getting a product out so people can consume it. In TV, that's a solved problem. In film, that's a solved, I mean, yeah, those are industries completely, in trouble. Completely. But in terms of, they don't reinvent the camera. They don't reinvent the projector and the cinema and the seats. And Phil and games, it's like, right, we are going to, the typical game project is, right, what's a genre of game we've never worked in before, an engine we've never used before, an IP we can't pronounce, you know, IP holders we don't speak the same language as. It's, this is not a recipe for coherence. But then, because Absolutely. That makes it so risk averse.
I'm feeling and, very called out at the moment.
but I think this has, as you said, this has knock-on effect of risk aversion. But also, and that has effects on in terms. You get games made out of other games because it's, oh well, we know that works. Yeah, in context that works
completely.
But there's a guy. Barry Sonnenfeld, who used to be the Coen Brothers DOP and you know, great director in his own right. And he's got a great spiel where he says, "Well, what do you think I do? I'm a movie director. What do you think I do?" And people say various things. He says every single one of those things is someone else's job. Where do I put the camera? I've got a DOP for that. The lights, I've got a lighting cameraman. Why do, well, you know, choosing the actors, casting. Well, how to do the scene? The actors are doing all that. The job as director is that I am the only person on set or on location who's going to be in the edit in a month's time. And you've got to have strong statements on things you may not even have opinions on. But his job is to answer, or the job of director is to just know when props say, oh, do you want the leather folder or the cardboard folder? To understand the end use of that prop in the structure of things. To go, oh, it's got to be the cardboard folder and it can't look new. And that is what a creative director ought to be, but they tend to be project leaders or lead designers. Very rarely is there someone in charge of the control of the tone of the game and the meaning of the content. And very often, writers are trying to do that at the last moment. They're trying to dig foundations that, you know, were not there when the building was constructed. And that's not just from my experience. It, you know, this is what I hear. It's not just, I'm going to say, it's not like, Splash Damage never knew how to make a game. Like, clearly, no, it's not that. It's that games of all sizes, it's very hard to make a game. What's that great Frank Lance quote about it? It's everything that's hard about building bridges combined with everything that's hard about making operas. You know, it's an engineering problem, and it's a creative problem, and it's a production problem, and it's a logistics problem. So quite often there just is a missing gap, or the person who should be making those creative decisions is swamped with management, keeping stakeholders involved, making the business case for the game. That is a full-time gig. And that doesn't get any simpler at either end of the scale in terms of it being, you know, a small team or an enormous team. So the thing I was writing was trying to build a bridge between the theory that we study as writers and narrative designers in terms of this is good practice and the need to, and how that relates to other the other disciplines we're working with, and trying to get away from, because the danger is either it's incoherent or it's over coherent. I think that's a, that, like, so let's say, does your game boot? Fantastic. Okay, you're up to a 60% review score. Congrats. Does it make any sense at all? You're up to 75%. Fantastic. That's great. But to get beyond that, you can't have every single discipline in the game trying to do all of the game at once. And the best games, the best anything, there is a harmonization and orchestration of the different elements to it. And if you've been in bad bands, you know that it's like, oh, everyone's trying to play the riff. Like, everyone's trying to play the melody. No, the drums do that. Like, everyone's working in concert and in harmony. And if you haven't worked together, shipped a game before, or it's not a genre you're used to, and you're not doing something you already know how to do, each department doesn't quite know how to do that. It's like everything in the game is trying to tell you the same thing at the same time. Like, this is exciting, this is dangerous, and, you know, the game design and the animation and the level design and the lighting and the physics and everything, it's like, yeah, this thing is watching itself. There's nothing for me to do here as a player, or as a, some bits of TV are like that. You just think, well, everything in here, the acting, the dialogue, the camera movement, the editing, the direction, the audio, the orchestration, like, it's all in the way of itself. And you think about those really great game moments where the ultimate refinement of any discipline, of any art, is to not do anything. And thinking about the end of Firewatch, like, where there's just, or Ghost of Tsushima, where you're just sat there, or Red Dead Redemption, where you're just sat on a horse and it starts to rain. Or worked on the multiplayer half of an Arkham game, and we're talking to Rocksteady about, you know, the early days. No, when Arkham Asylum, like, they hadn't been a good superhero game. It was amazing. And they did some focus group or test group, and people were having an amazing time chaining the moves together and really getting it. And one guy wasn't even holding the controller. He was just sat on the side of a building. And they came up to him and was like, oh, did we not explain the controls? And he went, shh, I'm being Batman. And so there you've got someone not really interacting with any of the systems of the game, who is their perfect player. Their perfect
player.
Because that's what the game does. It lets you be Batman. Like, when does your solution let the player do that? When does your solution let the player perfectly inhabit the role? Or are you just constantly trying to go, some more salt, some pepper, some more of this narrative? We've got some lore. We've got plenty of lore here. Would you like a cutscene? Because that stuff that's most obvious to the player is the least obvious thing at all when you're making it. That tonal thing, like what the music bed is, effectively. Yeah, what's setting the tone of the game.
I feel like so much of that somehow comes down to confidence. I'm not quite sure where that confidence needs to be applied, but like the end of Red Dead, they are so confident that you're in the moment and you're in the zone, that it's all working, that they can afford to take everything out. And I think that's what's so ballsy about the Limbo example you gave at the beginning, that like this is a game that's so simply presented and so stark and so kind of at odds with this idea of visual kind of mastery, even though it is very, very beautiful
or flourish,
it's not really playing the same game that other games are playing when it comes to visual one-upmanship, but it's so confident. And that confidence kind of carries so much impact with it that it makes you believe in this narrative, it makes you believe in this world, and it makes you believe that the rest of the game will continue this thing through. So I often feel like, how do we build for confidence? And like, especially from the bottom of the organization chart, how do we make everybody believe that this narrative is gonna fly without just saying, well, it worked for Aliens, so fingers crossed it'll work for us too.
Aliens is my literally, it's the example I teach of why you can't, like the bit at the end, get away from her, you bitch. You can't just allude to that. Like, that's not a clickable shortcut that will then launch an excitement exe. Like, the amount of work that has gone into setting that line up, the amount of structure that's gone in, the way in which a nested series of setups have been disguised as payoff. stops, payoffs. Really, really quickly. So there we go. Alien 1, Ridley's in just in the thing, drifting through space. She drifts right across the galaxy. He picks her up, depending which version, you either do or don't know that her daughter has died in the meantime. No one believes her story. She's working in the docks. And it's done in dialogue. Normally it would be show, not tell. But using one of those loader machines is really cool. So it's just described in dialogue. And it's by Burke, who understands how to use people, but is really constrained in his outlook. And he's like, oh, I could get your pilot. You come along to this thing to face the thing you fear the most. I could get your pilot's license. And he thinks it's about status. It's like, oh, right, because you're stuck there doing operating machinery. That feels like it's enough. Oh, it's leverage. So, okay, that's in the memory bank. Then she gets on the spaceship and there's all the Marines and they're all really cool and she feels like a spare wheel and she doesn't know what to do. Is there anything I can do? I don't know. Is there anything you can do? Well, I could drive that loader. Oh, she's really good at it. Okay, I accept you. We're building the team. And you've got half an hour to forget about it, that she can use that stuff. Then the Marine squad get ambushed in the big thing. Oh my God, what's going to happen? How are they going to get rescued? She drives the big industrial vehicle, knocks it, you know, drives through the wall and rescues them all. She saved the day. And then you've got an hour to forget that she can use heavy machinery. By which time you've also forgotten that we've shown you the flight deck. We've shown you there are these power loaders. We've shown you there's a second... So when she does come up, it's both surprising and inevitable, but also every single bit of setup has felt like the payoff to something else previously. Mm. That is I think there's a lot about Aliens that doesn't work. It's like smuggling in the components of a bomb, and each bit in itself is kind of, oh, I get it. Well, that's just a table leg, or that's just a vase, whatever. And then it's all there. And stand-ups organize, their acts similarly, like those nested callbacks. It can't feel like that's a thing I'm going to call back to later. It's got to feel like, oh, that did the job. Its job is, it's passed. Oh, of course, you needed it to do that. It's got to have a good cover story. And then when you take it away, I mean, as you say, the confidence, what was really surprising with Limbo is doing it early. Because other games, when it's stuff like Brothers or where they do a big thing at the end, no one's going to stop playing at that point. Firewatch, no one is going to tune out if they're that far in at that point. You've had so much buy-in.
Well, believe it or not, Ed, you are not the only person who has referenced stand-up comedy for this exact reason, for the sort of time between setup and payoff, right? And I think it's for a good reason, because those are really carefully designed sequences that are sort of tested. But they're also something different when it comes to something like stand-up, which is one person can hold the vision of that and test a bunch of different versions of it, a bunch of different models.
Iterate really easily.
Yeah. So they can get to the end and then remake the beginning once they realize what they're talking about. And maybe that is the thing that is much harder to do on most games. So when we see it in a particularly big way, it's especially impressive, right? When you sort of see it with a small team where you can imagine these five people could have been talking about the entire project the whole time. That's one thing. But on a big project, unless you have enough budget that you can redo all of the cutscenes, and who knows, maybe Rockstar had that for the first RDO, right? Like, it's possible. Otherwise, very often you sort of get to this point and you're like, oh, this is what it's all about. How do you deal with that?
It's kind of a thing of the past now, but when you'd work with a publisher that was doing a game guide, and it was so humiliating because you just ended up with the GDD you wish you'd had at the beginning. Like, oh, here's how all the systems work. Like, we didn't know that. Oh, I guess when you write it down, yeah, that is kind of... Yeah, that's exactly it. I think confidence is a key thing there, because it's fine to be wrong as long as it's something. As long as it's coherent, as long as it's, in the 1980s, there was some iconic UK TV ads for Levi Jeans. This ad agency went to Levi's, were absolutely, they were about to go out of business. And the agency very calmly said, right, what's your worst selling line? I said, well, the original, the 501 ones, no one wants those. It says, right, we're going to make them the number one thing. And they started putting out these beautifully directed, very iconic, using kind of Motown or soul music and stuff, beautifully shot, and it was a smash, huge hit. When other brands started making jeans adverts, sales of Levi's went up. Like, they were so associated as being the jeans brand. And they'd started doing a couple of these, and they really thought they'd got the hang of it. And they did one, and they shot it out in Texas, and it was like, this is great, it's going to go great. They get to the edit, and it is laugh out loud bad. They've written it to a particular song, it's storyboarded to within an inch of its life, they can't reshoot, the thing has to go for distribution, like, in a, over the weekend. And it's like, this is terrible, we are screwed, we can't do, and how can we fix this? Oh, God, you know, hacky, anyone, no bad ideas, what can we do? It says, well, try changing the music. And I don't know what the original track was, but they put on Muddy Waters' Mannish Boy, and everything synced up. Like, it is unbelievable now to think that ad was ever not storyboarded to that song. It can come in really, really late. Apparently, the movie Brassed Off, British, really unhappy shoot. Everyone was saying, oh, we're leaving this off our CVs. It was miserable. They put it together. And it's a quite a weird tonal mix of a thing. It just doesn't hang together. Some of it's super friendly. Some of it's really dark. And it was the one bit of really good notes from the studio. It's like someone just said, right, when I come back, I want feel-good pop music over every sequence in this film. And then they suddenly discovered what it was about. It's like, oh, it's fun. Like, you know, they'd finished the film before they'd found the tone of it. So it'd be comforting to think that you could plan all that stuff on paper, but a lot of it comes down to the music bed. Like, suddenly it will give your content coherence in a way that, frankly, the writing and performances did not endow it. It can come from all sorts of ways, but it really helps if you're just committing to one thing. Like, it was a great bit of direction from Brecht, Bertolt Brecht, is play one thing and then play the next thing. Don't try and say, oh, your character is brave but afraid. Don't try and play brave afraid. Play brave and then play afraid. And that will do. And that, it's one of those things that always seems to work. Like directing actors, I have no idea why, but the one note that always seems to work is, you're smarter than they are. Like, that always elicits something. I've written elsewhere about, like, you know, what's the best note, and it's a old Hollywood story, but Billy Wilder, and it's some, like, it's an office scene. There's hundreds of extras. They're all, you know, like, working in the background, and in between takes, he goes up to one of the background actors who doesn't have any dialogue, and just says, "It's the taste of the stamps." And he'd spotted that this actor was going to be a bit distracting because it was a bit out of it, and it's a perfect note because there's no adjectives in it. It doesn't say do it faster, slower, angry, sad. It gives dignity to the performer because they're supplying it. It's a sensory thing, so they can use their own memory and bring all of their art to it. But it's just a specificity to it. It's like, yeah, I know you're just one other person in the background to make it look like an office, but it's perfect. Like, there's so many ways you could make that work, and it humanizes it. And I think we're always on the lookout for those little moments of, there's lots of ways of doing this which are technically equivalent. Like, you know, that fine, we could do it this way or do it that way. But there's some specificity to it, even if it's not actually the in fact, especially if it's not state reprising the theme of the game. A just little moment of, oh, yeah, that's nice. That gets it. And it can come at any moment in any discipline. It can be the ambience. And just saying, you know, what happens if the ambience is kind of at odds with it? What if there's a nice rough edge somewhere? Because I think if you get a game that is coherent and it all makes sense, but it's kind of in unison, that's a kind of 75 to 80% game. And the games that do better than that either get to make themselves forever, or they've done things that don't all completely join up, and you as a player feel smart joining them, which sounds like a recipe for incoherence. But I think that's kind of the highest level of it is, you know what, that shouldn't make sense. It just works. But it really helps if you've solved all of the other problems, because for every other bit of uncertainty you've added, like, oh, the genre, the engine, the IP we're not quite sure of, oh, we're trying to combine these other things, you've just got less iteration time and less polish time, and you're more likely to come up with something that looks and sounds and plays like a computer game, but is kind of insubstantial. And there are those great moments that can be at a very low degree of fidelity. Like Papers, Please, you know, an obvious example. You know, would that game be better in 3D with, you know, high-res textures? Perfect thing. And that's the thing we get as games. There's a whole separate rant, which I nearly wrote, about the inverse relationship between movies and games, because it's all backwards. What's the cheapest thing, even the cheapest theatre production get? The human face reacting. What's the most expensive and difficult thing to do in games? A really realistic face reacting. And then everything's backwards. It's like, well, you know, all of our locations are props. We get helicopter shots for free, though. Once you have one explosion, you can kind of cut and paste it. You know, once you've made a building, it's not that much more difficult to make it fly around than just sit there. Apparently, this is not true in real life.
Like, apparently so, yeah.
So just to go back to that thing of, like, we're training using thinking about it like we're screenwriters. But the affordance, like, you know, just the cost and effectiveness is completely inverted. You know, cheapest thing in a film, close-up, maybe a two-shot. Two shots are really hard in games. Yes.
Unless you can perfectly animated, the cameras have to all be positioned, someone has to agree to schedule time for this.
You don't know where the camera's going to be. Like, literally, you don't. I mean, that's the one thing. Who is it? It was Jerry Lewis who invented video
playback. It's always behind a wall.
Yeah, or in front of some object that our team will be very upset at you for putting a close-up camera on.
Exactly. Which is a bit like, what was it? Someone asked Kurosawa, oh, in Seventh Samurai, like... The Seventh Samurai, not the Seventh Samurai, bloody hell. That's a Wu-Tang name. Why did you position the camera there? There's this really striking bit of framing you do. It says, well, because if I move the camera a meter that way, you see the Sony factory. And if I move a meter that way, there's a telephone pole. So that's why.
I want to jump in there.
Yeah.
So I think one thing that's really interesting about that is we've spoken to a bunch of people so far, and one reference that comes up a lot is theatre. And it makes a lot of sense, right? Because in theatre, you have quite limited technologies for communicating things, and they're quite separate in some ways, but they're kind of additive. You add lighting on top of the performance of the actors, which is added on top of the costumery, which is added on top of the set design. And these things are mostly orthogonal, right? The set designer doesn't really talk to the actors, and the actors don't really talk to the set designer. They just work in concert. And everything sort of stacks on top of each other and makes a richer production. And if all those departments are firing on all cylinders, they don't actually need to intercommunicate that much so long as they don't get in each other's way. And that sounds a lot like the model of game development you're talking about in some ways. There's a but coming. In that, so long as we aren't replicating each other's work, we can make the thing bigger and tougher. But it's also limited, right? I think what I'm getting from what you just said is that in games, there are actually some things we can do that would be extraordinary in a theatre context, like blowing the entire theatre up. Trivial in games, very, very difficult to do in reality. And so, like, that analogy of film can only take us so far, but we can get something from it. That analogy of theatre can only take us so far, but we can get something of it.
Everything gives you something for free, and there's something it can't do. Like, that's true. I heard that's about casting. Like, every actor gives you something for free, but there's things they just can't do. It can just be the stage. Like, it just gives you a possibility space. Mm. When I was working on Secret Wars for Marvel, working with a very, very good comics writer, and he kept on coming up with brilliant ideas we just couldn't do. And eventually I just said, like, oh, for bloody hell, is there anything you can't do in comics? And he said, pattern fabrics. Like, there is no tartan in comics.
No,
like, oh, right, so there isn't. Like, yeah, it means you can say, oh, look, and here's the universe exploding. And you can draw the universe exploding. You know, you can boil it down to that. They get that for free.
It's all over, yeah.
Yeah. I think, but partly it's self-selection, because the very fact that you're in a theatre space is the whole point of the stage, or whatever, however it's arranged, is here's a thing where things will be represented, not that you'll see the actual thing. And people buy into that really quickly. Whereas games are so literal. It's like, oh, here's the thing, and we're going to draw all the... Like, I know it's kind of a cliche, but the number of characters in Dickens that exist through one detail of their costume or their face. And they're incredibly vivid. And you know, it's like the old joke about radio's better than TV because the pictures are better. Whereas if you're trying to dramatise that, you've got to cast them and costume them and light them a certain way.
One of the things
and...
I really liked about 80 Days when we were writing it is that I'm fairly sure it's the computer game with the largest number of NPCs that has ever been made, because we have thousands of people, because we do the Dickens thing of, like, just, we'll introduce 17 people, we'll give you their names, and then we'll throw them away and it's completely free. And, like, I've often wondered, outside of the kind of very text-based sort of simple medium, like, how can we do more of that? How can we make our world bigger and richer without killing the budget immediately? Like, are there any tricks that we just haven't thought of?
Embrace the clunk. Find the clunkiest thing about your game and make that what the game is about.
Right.
Masks, mime, puppetry. Oh my God, the stuff that theatrical puppet people do. There was who's the guy? He did. He directed My Neighbor Totoro for the Royal Shakespeare Company. I've totally forgotten his name. He did a production of Beauty and the Beast, which had the most astonishing effect I've ever seen on stage. So some of it's played out, and there's a guy called, I think it's Matt Fraser, who was born, who's affected by thalidomide, who's got very short arms. His arms kind of stop as his elbows. So he had two assistant puppeteers who would be his arms. And it's all played out in front of you, but you just instantly, you know, one of them will stand behind him on his right side and one on his left, and the one on the right will use their right arm, left arm. And suddenly he's got arms. You just accept it straight away. They did a bit where they're telling the story. Okay, here's the framing narrative. So Beauty's father goes off and gets lost in the woods. And they bring out one of those old school overhead projectors. So it's like a big, it's a light box with a Perspex top, and you put transparent things on it, and it gets projected up into a prism, and it gets projected out. And they're showing it really obviously. They're not disguising it at all. And so you see, oh, here he is, and they've got a little kind of shadow puppet, and there's he goes over, walks over here, and then it cuts to first person. It cuts to, oh, and here we are. And you see there are these loads of leaves, like, you know, branches in front of him. And a hand reaches out and sweeps them away. And if you hold the transparency just a little bit off the surface of the projector, it goes out of focus. So they pull the branches aside, and there swims into focus the castle. And he goes into the castle, and he sits down at the door. And then it's suddenly he's eating dinner there. They've got transparent Perspex soup plates and drinks, you know, like there's a wine glass that lifts out of shot and you hear a slur.
So clever.
It's like, you just went third person and first person right in front of me using like old machinery.
Using classroom tech, right?
Yeah, using classroom tech. I have yet to see a game effect that was that profound. And I think clunkiness, I think puppetry is really under-resourced and underutilized. I think he may have been the same director. They did Shock-Headed Peter, Struwwelpeter. It was like an adaptation of these really dark 19th century nursery rhymes. And they did one sequence where, oh, a hunter goes out shooting, goes out rabbit hunting, and he falls asleep, and the rabbit shoots him, and he goes up to heaven. And again, they did it with puppeteers out in the open. And to show that the hunter has died, they've got little puppets of the hunter, you know, about a foot tall. They pin wings on him, angel wings on him. They've got a backdrop of blue, of just a blanket, so it's sky. And they've got some handheld clouds, which they move past the puppet downwards to make it look like he's ascending upwards. And I was just angry about that. Like, oh, we are so plushing, like crushing.
So focused on realism that we missed all the power we could have, like that.
Yeah. Or the cheat is, you have your intro cinematic and it's just a little girl voiceover. And it's like, oh, okay. It's like a low fidelity retelling of something that actually happened. Or, oh, what can we do? We can render textures really well. Okay, here's a cave painting lit by flickering, you know, flickering firelight. Here is a way we can represent what went on rather than show you cinematically. But I honestly, I think we spent too much time trying to copy movies, trying to, like, what the stuff that we're worst at, they're best at. And we could be using the framing and the clunkiness to portray that, the frustration of it. We could make the clunkiness meaningful.
One thing I really like about that as well is that it kind of leans back into your first point in a way, that if we have something that's clunkier and more kind of sellotape together, then it makes it easier to edit and it makes it easier to trade up and trade out those bits that don't work. Yeah. Whereas if you render this super fidelity scene, it's impossible, right? You just cannot throw away the money that you spent on it.
It was a thing I really could, I mean, I didn't have many meetings with Christopher Nolan for Inception, but you bet I asked him some questions about that. And his shtick was, because he always over-delivers on stuff. It's like, how can I... It's like, he wanted to do a heist film and a Bond film and a Jason Bourne film. Like, oh, I get to do them all. But his main problem with the heist genre is, okay, you build the team and you fix the problems, then who cares if you do it or not? Like, so what? It's like, one job... Like, what does he get from this one large job? Oh, he gets his kids back. So much so that he doesn't care. Like, there are very few great ending shots in films. I think Inception is right up there for me. Where... It's not, is this real, is it not? It doesn't matter if he does or not. He's got his kids back. That is perfect. It is both surprising and inevitable, and it's totally rooted in who he is and what he is. That there aren't a lot of those solutions floating around. So, but that degree of abstraction of, oh, here's this prop, and we've learned that that's how he tells if he's dreaming or not. He manipulates it and sees how it behaves. So it's always, I mean, I'm very much in favor of MacGuffins, but take a thing, and it's that setup payoff thing as well. It's like, oh, you think you fully comprehended its use to the player. It's like, no, it was there all along, and now it means something different. There is a Turkish film called Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, which apparently is based on loads of Chekhov short stories that I've just never read. And there's an amazing, like, Anatolia is huge and vast and almost featureless. And you're stuck in a car, and it turns out that it's a policeman, a police doctor, and a guy, a murderer. And they're trying to find the victim. They're trying to get the murderer to tell him, you know, to reveal where the body is. And it's going on forever, and you're bored, and they're bored, and you're, you know, you're very much stuck in the car with them. And if you slowly realise the murderer didn't do it, he's covering for his brother who did, so he's actually trying to solve the crime as well. Like, it's an amazing predicament. And, you know, I think a lot of people bounced off the first half hour. If I hadn't watched it in a cinema, I might have tuned over. But suddenly you're in the same predicament as one of the as one of the characters of, oh, he doesn't, it's not he's being an arse, he doesn't know where the body is. He's trying to puzzle it out as well as them without giving away the fact that someone else did it. And suddenly everything's alive. There's some weird example. What was it? Peter Cronenberg. Peter Cronenberg? No, that sounds
David
wrong.
Cronenberg?
David Cronenberg. Eastern Promises, about a sort of Russian mafia guy in London. And you go through it, and it's about two-thirds of the way through before you find out that the main character, who's the kind of enforcer, is actually an undercover cop. And everything he's doing, he's trying to not get himself busted, but is also trying to help people without blowing his cover. Which is the opposite of that whole Hitchcock thing of, oh, you know, you start off, you don't just have people talking at a restaurant and then suddenly a bomb goes off. You see the bomb, you see it primed, you see the clock ticking, you see it put in the bag, you follow the bag through traffic, you see it put under the table, you see someone walk off, you see other, you know, that's tension. That's like, it seemed like the most bizarrely anti-dramatic choice I've ever seen. It's like, how do you front load it so the things mean, so that things represent bigger things?
I'll tell you one game that has done this for me that actually I haven't forgotten, and which I believe was made just as a small demo, and that is The Intercept, John, actually, right? Like, The Intercept does this. The Intercept has this moment where you're like, what am I actually doing? Who is the character I'm really playing? And you feel this twist that, for some, depending on certain paths you take, might not even come out until the end. So we are clearly capable of doing this in games in certain ways. It's just it's as you say, Ed, right? Like, we're almost pulling sometimes the wrong lessons. And if the correct lesson from this whole podcast is the future, the once in future answer for the video game genre is text adventures, I will be very happy with that. I feel like that is a good outcome.
Well, the frustration is, you know for a fact with 100% certainty that whatever problem you're trying to fix, it has already been solved in a sister medium. Somewhere, some radio play, some stage play.
Yeah, you might have to dig, but you'll find it.
They had exactly that problem, possibly in a totally different or opposed genre, and they fixed it, and it's out there somewhere.
There was one lovely example of drawing from film that we encountered a few years ago when we were starting to put together Overboard, and I had this idea that I wanted to make a Christie game, and I was thinking about detective games and the way they always turn into a big UI fest of clues and things, and thinking, that's just I just don't want to have to build that. It feels confusing. And then I saw the film Knives Out. And Knives Out is a really good example, I think, of what you were talking about with the Turkish film Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, that, like, it's a whodunit, but a third of the way into the film, you know whodunit because you saw her do it, and it's the protagonist. And of course, it messes with that. But, like, and I won't spoil it if anyone hasn't seen it, but it was really revelatory for me of, as kind of, oh, right, hang on, we can take a trope that people really understand, and then we can just sort of upset the parameters of it. And then suddenly we have the tension, because the audience is like, well, I know how this story is supposed to go, and it's not going that way. And that gives us tension without us needing to sort of build it into the narrative in quite the same way. We can then have the narrative do something else completely, because the audience is already like, well, I'm in this until the third act to find out where the hell has this been sold as a whodunit, because I don't understand. And what I particularly liked was when I saw it in the cinema, and I don't know if this was standard, the very opening of the film was actually the director, whose name has completely fallen out of my head, even though he's one of my favourite directors of all time. Thank you, Ryan Johnson. Of course it is. Ryan Johnson saying, you know, hello, everybody. Welcome to Knives Out. This film is a whodunit, so please don't spoil the ending to people. And like, that's partly there because it's a, you know, what a great thing to ask audiences to do. But also to say, this really is a whodunit. And then a third of the way into the film, you're like, well, no, now I'm confused.
This is a man who's watched The Mousetrap many times over, right? Like he's sort of knows the power of sort of inviting the audience in, even when you're not there in person with them. And it's the same thing that you're talking about, Ed, right? This like, how can we sort of change the nature of the experience from one where the audience is seen as a sort of a thing to poke holes in the realism of what you're seeing, and they're sort of like brought into to the picture of the experience.
There's some combination of assets and tones and expectations, and that's what genre gives you. It's a kind of cluster, a kind of recognizable constellation of, oh, I get it. It's this kind of, it's in this ballpark. It's a song in the key of this. I think an understudied area in games is deception and counterintelligence, where, because you're trying to any story is, you're trying to deceive people. You're going to deceive them, like, this is a real story. We're going to get some actors to say things, and we're going to fool you into identifying with them. And the design of cons and the way in which they do all the work, the mark does all the work. You make them feel smart. You make them feel smarter than you. It's one of the frustrations I've got with Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is the central deception at the middle of it is so perfect. It's such an inspired piece of applied psychology, and none of the adaptations I've seen have actually sold it right. And it's not just because, oh, it's effective. It's the specificity of it works so hard because of who those people are. And it turns all of their strengths into weaknesses. And it's hard to describe in a short term, but there's something about the completeness and the thoroughness of, oh, here's what was actually going on. And it wasn't even about the thing you were like it's such a total defeat. There's something about well-planned deceptions. And sometimes that's in the field of intelligence. Like, what do you do when... for example, there was it's a classic example. In the American embassy in Moscow, they gave it, like, this big seal. Oh, look, it's this big carved wooden thing. And it had a bug in it, but it didn't have a power supply. It was very clever design that was kind of powered externally, and it read the difference in a signal. It's like, oh, okay, oh, right. Like, what happens if you know that there's a bug in the room?
Mm.
And that applies to one of my favorite kinds of scenes, is scenes where one person's on the radio or that they know someone else is listening in. I did once work with a guy who quite unkindly said to him, like, yeah, he always sounds like he's wearing a wire. Like, he just kept on providing an inappropriate amount of specific, like, locational information. Or like,
I'm reaching for the door handle now.
Yes. Okay, I'm going to mention everyone by name. I was like, okay, this feels weird. But there's something about that in terms of plotting to deceive the player, of they think they're playing one kind of game, and all along they have been actively constructing. Like, that's the thing. It's not just that you fooled them, they fooled themselves.
Yes.
Like, they, using all of their smarts and associations and expertise in the genre, they did all the hard work. They convinced themselves this thing was that thing, and you showed them right at the beginning. I mean, not to Nolan press out too much, but bloody hell, the beginning of the movie Prestige is unbelievable if you've seen it. It's the whole thing. He bloody shows you and tells you the whole thing is, oh my god. It's easier to do. It's something to do with visual treatment as well, because there's a lot of that that's inherent in terms of affordances and probably, oh, I get it, it's this kind of a game, the UI is this busy, here's how many things I can click on, here's the level of fidelity in which the world is portrayed. Like, there's a lot of choices in there about what you're saying is or isn't important. And it's very important to, you know, for players to know, nah, this isn't the whole thing. Like, this is a grayed out thing. Don't bother trying to open every door in the game. Oh, Liz England, a door problem. How do you imply to players, yeah, there's lots of doors, but these are pictures of doors. There's not actually more content there. How do you make their expertise in navigating that the way in which they fool you? I mean, maybe that doesn't work for everything. Some things can be a beautiful journey and a kind of a passaggio, an experience, like, you know, a trip you go on. I think there are very, you know, like Knives Out. How do you keep writing Knives Out sequels? Like, you know, you've got this amazing ta-da ending and you go into it expecting it to be...
It's harder that way. But I mean, I think it's a big tent, right? Our medium. Like we can have a variety of different experiences here. And all in all, I mean, I think there cannot possibly be a better way of winding us back to the beginning than to talk about how important it is to deceive our players. I feel that is the perfect moral for us to come through here. And we could go on for hours, I feel. There's so much here. Thank you for giving us all this, but I'm afraid we might have to bring the episode to a close. This has been an absolute blast. I hope we get another chance to talk again soon.
Your
article, The Tina Fey Hat Problem, is very recommended for our listeners to have a look at. We've been Sagar and John here. This has been the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Next week, we will be opening the book yet again, finding another article, and speaking to that author about their contribution. See you next time.
Cheers.